Welcome back to BCFM Politics Show. Me, Tony Gosling. Martin Summers, Marie-Lou Storm and Afzal Stars Shah is staying with us too for a few minutes. 50 dead and another 50 hospitalised in Australia by a far-right terrorist in Christchurch, New Zealand. Although journalists have garnered all sorts of threats, hate and even a crude manifesto from social media, apparently the Antipodean secret services knew nothing about alleged gunman Renton Tarrant at all. We've all about the wonders of self-driving cars. Enter the self-driving Boeing 737 MAX 8. The Ethiopian airliner that came down at the weekend, identical crash to October's Lion Air. What is the so-called stick pusher, which automatically puts a plane into a nosedive, overriding the pilot up to? 50 years after the first flight of Concorde, why have Boeing, the FAA and the EU been so slow to ground this killer airliner? Plus, it's not just Shamima Begum, a phalanx of jihadi brides, have now been banned from returning to the UK, even though they were entrapped and groomed online while still kids. Who's making the decisions to strip these women of their British citizenship, and why are MI5 and MI6 afraid for them to return when hundreds of male fighters have returned without even being interviewed by our police and secret services, despite being trained terrorists? And what about David Cameron's secret memo giving our secret services a license to kill? Was Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley right when she supposedly misspoke in the Commons last week, suggesting they're above the law? After all, she's still in her job. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, noon on Tuesday this week. Spartacus Educational's John Simpkin runs through some of Bristol's unsung heroes of history. And from Rhode Island, USA, Professor Vladimir Goldstein gives us a short tour of Russia and Russian literature, as well as pondering over the reasons for Russophobia in the West. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. But first to New Zealand, and thanks for staying with us, Afzal, because I know you've been to Friday prayers today, and it must be on the thoughts of many Muslims right across the world right now.
People are absolutely shocked by the sheer level of killing and the gruesome manner in which this terrorist, for that is what he is, actually took his submachine gun and just calmly went around butchering people in that mosque and pursuing children and not leaving until he could kill as many people as possible. And it raises a lot of questions, though, about the failure of intelligence. But it's good to see that there are media organisations who are calling this individual a terrorist rather than saying that he's got potential mental health problems or that he's a lone wolf. It's just that we have to call it out for what it is. This is cold-blooded terrorism. And I think that's what we have to condemn it for. And here in Bristol, it's great that we've seen so many messages of solidarity and support, people coming together. So during these dark, difficult hours, it has actually brought communities together.
It's interesting, isn't it? The BBC refused to call the guy a terrorist for quite a long time until, I think it was the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Yeah. Then once she did, they said, but it seemed pretty obvious to most people looking that it was a terrorist attack. Martin, I wonder, what is the difference between, say, a lone wolf and a terrorist? And why are some of these media organisations reluctant to use the word, the T word?
Well, we often say alleged shooter yourself earlier. Because, of course, there are legal implications of this, and I think it's to do with obviously there's an element of racism. You know, if it's a Muslim, it's a terrorist. If it's a white person, it's an individual actor. But I mean, don't forget, in this case, he didn't act on his own.
Well, we saw the same thing actually in the Joe Cox murder, didn't we? Yeah. There's initially a reluctance to call that a terrorist attack.
Yeah, but I mean, I think this pretty much, if you're going to use terrorism for anything, he didn't act alone. It's a team. Several people have been arrested. There were bombs involved. He didn't just turn up on.
Two years in the planning.
Yeah. Indeed. And, of course, the real question behind underlying all of this is who, as we know, on this show we've covered the relationship between terrorism and the intelligence services. We do it as one of our main themes. And there's usually more to things than meet the eye, just as the Manchester bomber was part of this Libyan Islamic fighting group, which had been based in Manchester since the 1980s, had been run by British intelligence to try and overthrow Gaddafi. His father was in Libya at the time he supposedly carried out the bomb attack in Manchester. And most people in this country are blissfully unaware that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group have been working intimately with MI6 since the 1980s, as Dave Shaler and Annie Machon, who broke from MI5 over exactly that, will tell you. And most people have got to realise that very rarely is a terrorist act. People in Pakistan will know this, that when a terrorist act happens, there's usually something else behind it, not just crazy people, but military intelligence officers, either Pakistani or Indian intelligence officers. The research analysis wing of the Indian Army engages in this sort of thing. This is the real world. And if we want to put a stop to terrorism, we've got to look at the links
about
that
raw,
there are.
Talking about raw, Afzal, I know the Pakistani community here in Bristol has been really concerned about what's been going on in Kashmir too over the last few weeks.
Yes, so people have been very concerned. A couple of weeks back, I organised a get-together because in Easton, a very diverse part of Bristol, we've got the Pakistani Welfare Organization on Stipton Road, but we've also got the city's only Hindu temple on Church Road, and it was to ensure that we maintain harmonious relationships. So we've had a meeting of members of the Sikh, Indian and local Pakistani communities to essentially show unity amongst each other. But there is concern that in India, specifically because of the right-wing media pandering to the BJP election, which is coming in several weeks' time.
Well, that's right. Some have said that this could be linked to Modi and electioneering, because he's soared in the polls as a result of what's happened.
He absolutely has. You know, you saw this back in, I think it was 2003, when he turned a blind eye as chief minister in Gujarat to the killing of thousands of Muslims there. He was actually declared he was actually stopped from visiting the UK, America, many other countries in the West. Here he is now. Whenever he flies over, he's touted as some kind of, you know, messianic figure. And you've seen it with Obama, you've seen it with Trump, you've seen it with leaders in this country, with David Cameron, that they all embrace him. And it's because money talks, but he is. And it's interesting that the media say he is a nationalist. No, he's not. He is a fundamentalist. He uses, he actually targets and baits Muslims and, in fact, Christians as well, just specifically so that he can build up his vote bank. And he is a hardcore Hindu fanatic, and recently targeting Pakistan in the election, his figures have actually soared.
It does seem to me, Martin, that we see a lot of the faiths used in this way, Islam and Hindus. Actually, many of the leaders that are using those words, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, actually don't actually bear any relationship to what the people of faith believe whatsoever.
Well, I mean, the problem for all human beings is the problem of sin, if you like, Tony, is that people can take the most marvellous things, religion or socialism, if you like, that can, you know, secular socialism can be turned into a monstrous evil by the wrong people. And I'm afraid that's just the problem that human beings have, isn't it?
I mean, we've seen in Australia, for example, the Catholic paedophile priest. I mean, it's the perfect place. The church is the perfect place for wicked people to hide as well sometimes.
Well, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So everybody pretends to be virtuous, but obviously not everybody is.
I should say that given the recent tensions between India and Pakistan, which are both nuclear armed states, the Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, all of these defense contractors, Boeing as well, their shares rocketed because they knew that India will now spend billions and billions and billions. So on the one hand, you've got Trump calling for peace between these two countries, but on the other hand, you've got these defense contractors lining up and flying out to India and saying, you know what, if you really want to beat the Pakistanis, buy from us. You've also got Israeli industries as well saying that buy from us because we've got the best counterintelligence machinery available, and learn from us in terms of the way that we've been dealing with the Palestinians. You can also deal with the Pakistanis in a similar manner. However, what they fail to recognize is that this has global impact. God forbid, if something happens between these two countries, it will have an impact globally. It's not just that there will be nuclear fallout between these two countries, it will affect the whole world. And I think we cannot do enough, and I think it's very sad that that the United Kingdom, which was sadly responsible for all of this in the first place, has not taken a more assertive role. But that's because we are so focused on Brexit, everything else we've lost sight of.
Martin, let's look at Kashmir for a minute then, and mm-hmm. the history and the partition when it came to independence for Pakistan and India. This was a particular region, Kashmir, which many people said should go into Pakistan, but it stayed with India. And that's been almost a running sore ever since. Has there been really attempts to sort that out? Well, and it's almost like the British did this deliberately. I don't want to mean to be too much of a conspiracy theorist here, but we did the similar sort of thing, the British Empire in the Middle East, didn't we? Where we're drawing lines specifically to create future tensions.
Well, it's very complex, as you can imagine. There's a lot to be said. If we were going to go into it, we need a history seminar.
Well, you mentioned, I think last week, something about having a referendum.
In theory, there was going to be a plebiscite because the majority in Kashmir were Muslim, but the Maharaja, but the Maharaja of Kashmir was a British puppet, and he decided to go with India, and it was kind of because don't forget, it was all done in a hell of a rush. Mountbatten wanted to get the whole thing done as quickly as possible, and Afzal may disagree. Maybe he can come in, but it's either a cock up or a conspiracy. But either way, it's ended up a hell of a mess, hasn't it?
So the Maharaja Hari Singh, in terms of signing the instrument of accession, is clearly shown that he wasn't there. He was travelling to Srinagar from New Delhi. There's no way that he could have signed it on the 27th. It was shown that it was signed 24 hours later. Yeah. So there is a lot in terms of the way that this seems to have been stage managed. Mm-hmm. And also the Indian troops were airlifted in to Srinagar. It was essentially a takeover. Yeah. But I think the key thing is now that bilateralism really has failed. You need a third-party mediator to clash heads. And also, I think it's actually criminal about the United Nations, because what have they been doing? They have a moral responsibility and a legal responsibility to actually ensure that they're honest brokers. But all they've been doing is just saying, oh, we need peace, we need peace. And I think that we forget there are United Nations resolutions talking about the plebiscite. Mm. And there are innocent people who are being killed on both sides. And we need an honest broker, but we also need the Kashmiris to be at the negotiating table.
Yeah, well, what do you make of Imran Khan now as leader? Has there been a difference in the character in Pakistan?
So Imran Khan has got class. I mean, so I like the way that he's handled this situation. You can see the difference between Modi, who has come out and been very aggressive, but you've seen Imran Khan, who's actually reached out with an olive branch, and he took the opportunity to release the Indian pilot as a gesture of goodwill. But every time Pakistan has actually offered an olive branch, India said no. We want you to renounce any claim over Kashmir, and then we'll come to the negotiating table. And we should not forget that since 1989, over 100,000 innocent Kashmiris have been killed, many of them in fake encounters by the Indian military. And I should add, why do you need 750,000 soldiers in the Kashmir Valley. It is the most heavily militarized place on earth. It's not North Korea. It's Indian-occupied Kashmir, well, which is the most heavily
militarized place. It's not a million miles place. Away, a few thousand miles away anyway, Martin, is Myanmar or Burma, where we've seen fascinating power plays going on there, with the Rohingya Muslims being given arms and supplies by Saudi Arabia. And then, lo and behold, the Israelis turn up and help out the Burmese government. And that helps to fuel the conflict. So you've got the Saudis on the one hand. It does seem as if Muslim communities all over the world, I mean, particularly in that region, it's not just the Middle East we're talking about, are being targeted too with these divide and rule tactics, where actually the only real winners are the arms companies.
Well, I think that's it. That divide and rule sums it up. Don't forget, a lot of the people behind what's going on are students of classical ancient history, and in actual fact they do read their ancient history, and this is what goes on. There was manipulation.
So which books are they reading? The same books as
Tacitus.
Yeah. Same books as you. Yeah.
You create a wasteland and call it peace, all of that. I mean, most of the critique of imperialism is there as well.
Sounds like divide and ruin, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's the problem is that, to my mind, a lot of this stuff has become so ingrained that it's not even cynical, it's just irrational. You know, they do it because they can, and it's not even going to get them what they want.
Well, it is. It's going to make lots of money from arms sales. Anyway, Afsal, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I completely agree with you. And it is a case of divide and rule. You have to look at Mountbatten, Radcliffe. That's exactly what they sought to actually do. If they were going to leave India, they were going to leave it in flames. And you see this 7 decades on. And although India's economy is increasingly liberalizing, and we pander to Modi when he comes to the West, I think that there is a moral obligation on the West to ensure that they use all their soft power, to use all their approach with India and the United Nations and the European Union, but also with the Commonwealth.
We have a problem, though, don't we?
We've not said anything about the Commonwealth yet.
For many people, actually, war makes more money than peace.
It absolutely does.
Well, yes, and of course it's not to be seen in isolation either, because we've got this. But don't forget, after the 9/11 attacks, which we discussed last week with Ian Henshaw, there has been a power play by the Western powers to try and stop rising powers from taking their crown, specifically the Chinese and the Russians. Of course, the Chinese are in alliance with Pakistan in a. They're hoping to build infrastructure to bring
CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is part of the One Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah. But of course, that shouldn't be seen as a threat by India or the US. This is an opportunity for everybody to prosper if it's approached in the right way.
Said it. Italy wanting to become a member of OBOR with China just earlier this week, and the Americans have actually got very angry about this. But actually, going back to India, the Americans are very keen for India to contain
China
alongside Australia, alongside Japan. So they want to form this group of four, the Quad Four, the Quadrilateral Four, to essentially contain China. But what they fail to realise is that the Chinese are actually modernising their own forces, their own military, their own economy. So I think, sadly, all this money being pumped into the industrial military complex, it's just creating a more of a tinderbox situation. And the only people who lose out are those who those poor impoverished people, such as those in Burma, such as those in Kashmir. And I would say once again that Kashmir really is a stain on the conscience of the British psyche. Over 70 years and no attempt has been made by Britain to try to get this resolved. And I think that's an absolute shame.
I mean, one of the really appalling sides of all of this, thanks very much for staying with us, Afsal, is to discuss that, is the way that the press in Britain has covered a lot of this, or not covered it, so to speak. And I did promise a few weeks ago, as I noticed on the BBC World Service, there was an omission of the links between Chatham House and the US intelligence services. So when you hear someone from Chatham House coming on the BBC, as they do all the time, talking about international affairs, where do they really come from? Let's have a little lesson. It's only a short clip from World Update on the BBC World Service now.
Well, we can speak to Matthew Page now, Associate Fellow at the think tank Chatham House, their Africa programme, formerly the US intelligence community's top Nigeria expert. So, Matthew, thanks for being with us.
And there he just said it. The top CIA's top, well, he didn't actually say CIA, US intelligence community's top Nigeria expert, now Chatham House. So there's a sort of revolving door, Martin, isn't there, between the intelligence services and what we're getting on the BBC as so-called independent experts.
Yeah, it's quite interesting this week. They approached the Ministry of Defence and approached various universities, including Cambridge University, to help them with their psychological warfare programme. And they even said to Cambridge University that they would help them with dealing with any negative publicity that the university might get from being involved in such a programme. And a senior person from the science History of Science, I've forgotten his name now, but he's often on TV, and he said, well, I'm glad this has all been knocked on the head, because it's very bad for the reputation of the university to be seen to be involved in this sort of thing. But they're still out there looking for a university. I understand Lancaster University are now thinking that they might be involved in the psychological warfare programme. And
this is just mind-bending, isn't
it? It is. Really? What we're talking about
is... This is a professional lying. Remember, we had Bill Pottinger faking these videos, which were then used all on the TV in Iraq.
Well, it's what they call strategic communications. And, of course, what it means is basically using so-called independent media, or what people think is independent media, the BBC, for example, as part of a psychological warfare programme to, for example, take out Maduro in Venezuela, where we're hearing all sorts of disinformation about what is and what is not happening. There's a massive amount of media out there now, but a lot of the mainstream media are bought and paid for, either by corporations or by governments, but less so on this programme, folks.
Yes. We're not, folks. No, we're definitely not. Anyway, I thought we ought to have a look at this whole business of the jihadi brides, particularly since I did an article about Shamima Begum back in 2016, citing Turkish press reports that Canadian intelligence had actually recruited Shamima when she was age 15 from a school in East London, Bethnal Green, and brought her over to... I mean, it's basically online grooming using Facebook, that sort of thing. The guy that had done it had been promised by the Canadian government that he would get a Canadian passport out of it, Martin.
Yeah, and isn't it extraordinary that of all the fuss there's been in all the media in Britain about this girl and a baby dying and all the rest of it, and whether she should be allowed back or not, the obvious thing that hasn't been pointed out, she was groomed online when she was underage, and the person who was grooming her was not from ISIS. Well, he was from ISIS, but he was working for the Canadian intelligence services. And if people think back to 5-6 years ago, our intelligence services were getting people from all over the world to go to Turkey and then be sent into Syria to overthrow the evil government of Assad, who had won the democratic election in Syria in 2012 in very difficult circumstances, and he looks as if he's won the war. And of course, if these people come back and are put on trial, they're either not put on trial at all, as you say, they just come back and blend in.
Okay, just hang on a second. Hang on a second, Martin.
Sorry, this is going to come out.
Hang on a second, because I thought it was quite interesting. Who is it exactly that makes the decisions about who comes back and who doesn't? Because that was revealed at the weekend on Radio 4 by Rory Stewart, who, of course, is a former Bilderberg attendee. He's also chair of the Defence Select Committee. He's now prisons minister, but he let it slip at the weekend on Radio 4 who makes these decisions.
There are reports that two more women in Syria have been stripped of their British citizenship.
When these decisions are made, the security service is involved, the intelligence service is involved. These are very, very serious processes that take place. As you know, I spent quite a lot of my life working in Iraq, been in Syria. I can not emphasize enough just how horrifying and disturbing Daesh, the Islamic State, was, and that the action of these people going to join it was done open-eyed to join a state which has been responsible for some of the most extreme atrocities known.
Well, the fact is that the Western intelligence services, working with MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, were bringing people from all over the world.
But we were told, the point here is, we were told
to infiltrate them into Syria.
Syed Javid, the Home Secretary, had made this decision. Of course, he's just making it because MI5, MI6 are telling him to.
That's right. And of course, they, as Thierry Masson, the French journalist who's based in Damascus, has pointed out, they don't want any of these people to come back. They either don't bring them back at all, like in this case, or they brought back like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group people who were allowed in and out of the country without any kind of checking at all because they're working with the Western intelligence services. And most ordinary people in this country do not realise the intimate relationship that there is between the jihadi terrorist networks and our own intelligence services. Well, and in Syria, it's absolutely clear what's been going on. They've been trained by our own special forces to go and fight Assad, and then we call them terrorists, okay, even though we've trained
them. Let's have a look at some evidence of that anyway. Terror trial, this is back in Monday the 1st of June 2015 in The Guardian. Terror trial collapses of fears of deep embarrassment to security services. Swedish national Berlin Gildo's lawyers argued British intelligence agencies were supporting the same Syrian opposition groups as he was. The prosecution of a Swedish national accused of terrorist activities. So, Martin, that's another case.
Well, that's right. That was a case in the... and that's pretty clear. That was a case in the Old Bailey, and they said you've been in Syria, you've been working for ISIS or whatever the group was he was working with, and his defence lawyers argued, yes, but you basically recruited him. The MI6 are supporting exactly the same group that he's claimed to be a member of. And, of course, at that point, the trial dropped. Now, the other thing I would point out about people who have been carrying out terrorist acts inside Syria is they ought to be extradited to Syria, even as British citizens. And that surely should be what happens if they've been engaged in terrorist activities inside Syria.
Well, there's some more stories as well. I mean, that's just one. Moazen Beg was freed after a terrorism case against him collapsed. Secret intelligence material handed to prosecutors demolished the case against former Guantanamo Bay detainee.
Well, Moazen Beg had basically been cooperating with MI5, and then what you do is the problem for people who cooperate with intelligence services is they can hang you out to dry at any point. You think that you're like this Canadian guy thought that he was working with Canadian intelligence. He wasn't Canadian. He was may have a Canadian passport. I can't remember. But the fact is, if you do deals with these people, they've got power over you, and they can just get you killed. They can hand you over to people. At one stage in the rendition process, for example, the Syrian government, before they became put on the naughty step, they were extraditing people from all over the world to Syria to be tortured by the Syrian police so that they could then pass information back to the Western powers. And of course, if you play games like that with people like that, you end up getting burned. But the whole thing is much more complex than people realise. And I think in Syria, for example, it just came out not that long ago, the Chemical Weapons Inspectorate have said, well, in actual fact, there wasn't a chemical weapons attack in Douma. That was staged by the White Helmets. On the basis of that, we carried out several missile strikes inside Syria. And, of course, what the Syrians and the Russians could have decided to do is fire back at the RAF base in Akrotiri and kill your service people. If you're going to kill our soldiers, we're going to kill your soldiers. Just because they've got white faces, they bleed the same.
OK, we've also got a British double agent who plotted to kill his MI5 handler and attack the UK after infiltrating a jihadist group in Syria. An MI5 agent allegedly recruited by a terrorist mastermind in Syria, then sent back to Britain in a plot to launch an attack against MI5. An undercover operation was launched to try and track any similar plots. Scotland Yard has arrested the man and he remains in police custody. Now, that's also in it's a couple of years ago. That was in 2015. The agent was recruited by MI5 as an undercover informant within the radical Islamic community. He then travelled to Syria when he became part of a jihadist group and apparently double-crossed his British handlers and tried to return to London with plans to launch an inside attack on the capital. I mean, they're playing with fire, Martin.
Well, they are playing with fire. At the very least, you could say they're playing with fire and then they get burned. But it's worse than that. I'm quite sure that the Syrian intelligence services, the Russian intelligence services, the Iranian intelligence services and the Irish police force are very well aware of how the British intelligence services work, which is basically they've got their finger in every pie. And I understand we might be discussing some of the issues, for historic issues from the Irish conflict before the end of the show, but that's the real world. Don't presume that these are the good guys and that they are on your side. They're not accountable to us. They're accountable to shadowy forces we don't really understand, and they're engaged in all sorts of double bluffs and triple bluffs. It's a much more complicated picture than people imagine.
Okay, well, we've got one or two other similar sorts of cases. David Cameron also gave MI5 agents apparently a licence to kill in a secret letter saying that they should not be prosecuted for their crimes. MI5 agents authorised to participate in murder, torture and sexual assault, yet no police officer or prosecutor has ever been told of their criminal activities. A secret letter from the former Prime Minister David Cameron was made public. Now, this was all around about 2018, last year, but it's only just become public, Martin. So it does seem as if what Karen Bradley said, which I'm about to play, what she had to say, may even be, possibly even be true, that there is this real... And it was interesting at the time, as the DUP guy was sitting nodding behind us, so maybe they're in on this idea that you've got a kind of... hit squads of secret police that are able to kill with impunity in this country. So let's have a listen to what Karen Bradley, Northern Ireland Minister, said last week.
Over 90% of the killings during the Troubles were at the hands of terrorists. Every single one of those was a crime. The fewer than 10% that were at the hands of the military and the police were not crimes.
Well, I mean, this is in relationship to this one soldier F who's going to be... They're going to dump the whole Bloody Sunday thing on him. And of course, in actual fact, the people who should really be in the dock are not the individual soldiers who did the shooting, but Colonel Robert Ford of the Parachute Regiment, who gave the orders, because it was in actual fact an orchestra. It wasn't just a random thing. Bloody Sunday went on for 20, 25 minutes, and lots of people were killed, and it was actually planned in advance. And of course, as Karen Bradley pointed out there, only less than 10% of the killings were carried out directly by the army, but Brigadier Gordon Kerr, was running the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland for many years, and he was going to be put on trial by Sir John Stevens for running the Loyalist terror campaign. In other words, everybody killed by the Loyalists was ultimately being killed by the British Army, as everybody in Ireland knows, actually, but most people on this side of the water are blissfully unaware. They think that we're fighting jihadi terrorism around the world when we're actually funding and supporting it from the 1980s onwards, and they thought that the British Army was there trying to keep the two sides apart in Northern Ireland, when in actual fact they were 100% behind one side and against the other. Now, these kind of techniques have been going on for years, but because of the war in Ireland in this country, there's an awful lot of people who have a great deal of understanding of how this stuff actually works. In the US, people have a very, very limited, and I dare say in Switzerland, people have a very limited understanding of how these operations are carried out. In this country, we've had a 30-year civil war, and lots of information has come out for those who've been paying attention about how these kind of operations are conducted.
Now, I hope on the line sort of right now, Martin, we're joined on a separate story, but linked, as you usually are, by Roger Sanders. Can you hear us, Roger?
Yeah, I got you, yeah.
Okay, Roger, I know you live close to Fairford in Gloucestershire, don't you? Can you just tell us what has been going on up there this week?
We've got, this week's been arriving the whole flight, half a dozen, eight or so of the American B-52 Super Fortress bombers.
What is Fairford Air Base and what's been going on up there recently?
Okay. Well, Fairford Air Base, has been, for the last 10 years or so, it's been almost redundant. But then a few years ago, it was expanded considerably under sort of NATO agreement, NATO financing, which increased it into a standby type of facility. Now, off and on, we get these huge planes come, you know, and they were used from Fairford during the Iraqi war, and they were also used from Fairford to bomb Serbia in the former Yugoslavia problems. Now, a lot of time they come in, it's always a signal that something's going to happen. The concerning thing is this time, we've got eight of them come in this week, and then they're usually backed up by the B-1, and I don't know for sure, but by the B-1 bombers as well.
So are you a bit of a plane spotter, Roger? Are you a bit of a plane spotter yourself?
Well, I just know about planes, yeah, I am a bit of a plane spotter, yeah.
So what the Americans, I imagine, will be saying is that this is just another NATO exercise, Roger.
It is a NATO exercise, what I'm concerned about is these huge aeroplanes flying directly over our town of Stroud. You know, if anything happens, God forbid, forget the possibility of any sort of strike or anything, But if anything happened to one of those planes and they come down in the vicinity of Gloucester, Cheltenham, Stroud, it would be absolutely horrendous. And they fly directly over our town. They fly directly over my house, which I'm not being that self-sufficient. It's my house, but they fly directly over lots of built-up areas. Now, coming and going, it depended, I think, on the wind, what have you. But the concerning thing is, this time, is to do the NATO exercise, which is taking place in Georgia. And Georgia, of course, is the former Soviet Union. And it's and I see it, it's so-called defensive thing, but I think it's also part of the saber-rattling against the Russian sort of build-up, you know.
Can you just give us an idea of what's been happening with the development? You're saying that it's been expanded at Fairford recently.
Yes, it's been expanded several times. The actual, I think in one time, the actual runway was expanded. It can take full-size aircraft. I mean, it was a test bed for Concorde when they were flying Concorde. So it would take the largest aircraft, you know, whatever size, whatever shape, whatever dimension, whatever they're doing. So it's a huge runway. The facilities is huge facilities, which was left from the Second World War. And as I said, it's been made redundant, come back into force, been redundant, back into force. But it's been a standby. It's been a NATO standby facility for several years.
Do you actually see much of the US Air Force personnel at all around the area?
No, very, very little of it. I mean, if you go to science, we're like 10 or 12 miles in a straight line from Fairford, which on a flight path, of course, is considerably close. But we see nothing of the... because as they come and go, they bring with them their backup teams. Now, evidently, in the next 2 years, they're going to build up a force of American military workers, we'll call them, for want of a better word, to service the facility. And there's something up to 2,000 Americans due to move into Fairford in the next 2 years.
Well, Roger, thanks very much for joining us. A little update. I haven't heard about anything much about that on any of the nationals. But Martin, a whole load of B-52s turning up in these massive old Vietnam-style bombers up at Fairford.
Yeah, well, but by far the most likely relation, this is definitely Russia-related, it could be that they're going to go for a simultaneous kind of conflict in Venezuela, in Iran, and in Ukraine, Georgia. It seems crazy, but these are not necessarily rational people. And if you're going to go to war, you might as well go the whole hog. Yeah?
So you think this is all Russia-connected potentially?
Yeah, well, if it's based in Fairford, it must be. They could be related to the Middle East, but they're probably... I mean, don't forget, they flew from Fairford to bomb Iraq, because we went down to protest. If you remember, we went down to protest every week for several weeks before, because it was quite clear what was going to happen. And then they flew and they bombed Iraq from Fairford.
And on Dialect on Tuesday, we've got an interview with a chap called Vladimir Goldstein in the US. He talks about Russian literature, but one of the things he also mentions in the interview, and that's on at noon on Tuesday, you can hear, is the EU leaders are not really showing very good leadership. Would you agree with that? He's saying that they really should look more towards Russia in the East than they're looking all the time to America.
Elites in the West are over a barrel because the Americans make sure they are. I mean, the French General de Gaulle kicked NATO forces out of France.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. Why did the British have to accept these B-52s here?
Well, we are probably closest to the Americans of all the European countries. Don't forget, France and Germany did not want to go to war in Iraq.
We're physically close, but what about the political? Why does the British government have to say, yes, you can have your American bombers based
well,
in
we,
here?
We're talking
in fact, they used to call it, didn't they? Mm-hmm. They used to call it the unsinkable aircraft.
Well,
carrier.
That's right. We're Airstrip 1, as George Orwell used to call it in 1984. We are definitely their little bulldogs. And that's why de Gaulle didn't want us in the EU originally. And, of course, de Gaulle kicked all military US military bases out of France in 1960. And if we're talking about independence and sovereignty, there's no foreign military bases in Switzerland, is there? There's none at all. And that's what independence looks like.
Yes, we're a colony, folks. But anyway, let's have a listen to Vladimir Goldstein now as he explains a little bit about why the European Union, Brussels, and Europe generally should be thinking a little bit more about having better relations with the Russians, because we don't really want to have a war in Europe sparked off by the Americans.
It's more or less a question of EU, and I think they don't have, for the time being, they don't have sort of very solid leaders. Basically, it's a task of the leaders to sort of to assert themselves in Europe and say, you are more than happy to deal with America, but we also need to deal with Russia. Because, you know, they are very neighboring countries. You can just, you know, much easier to trade and whatever. And I think what will send finally a message to Europe is the China, which will, you know, to trade with Europe, it has to go through Russia. So I think, you know, this geography is more or less becomes an inevitability and the fate. So Europeans will have to be integrated. You know, we can be rest assured that the United States, it's not in their interest. They are more or less removed from this center of action. So they would still try to come, and I think this, for example, the Ukraine story is one of the ways to split, you know, this inevitable process of merging. But it's the only thing it can do is slow down. We see how sort of, you know, nobody is interested much in Ukraine. It's sort of, it's a corrupt country, and eventually Europeans will say, okay, either you become part of it, stop your hostility, stop being, you know, a buffer between the two countries, and get integrated into this big trade between Russia and Europe, and get on with it, or just be kind of abandoned country like some kind of Rwanda in the middle of Europe. But I think, of course, the United States will try to exploit the situation, keeping Poland and keeping, you know, Russia and Ukraine as some kind of a split between Europe and Russia. But I think they will merge eventually, no doubt.
Well, I mean, there's clearly a geopolitical struggle going on for the soul of Europe, if you like. The Germans, for example, are ploughing ahead with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will bring natural gas from Russia to Germany at a cheap price, which they will then sell on to other European countries. But, of course, the Americans are very hostile to this. They're saying that they're going to bring sanctions against the companies which are involved. And they are trying to break up this kind of potential marriage, if you like, between Russia and Europe. And, of course, historically, Switzerland has been independent. You don't; they're not even in the United Nations, I understand. Although it's based in Geneva, Switzerland is not even a member of the United Nations, because that's been the culture going back to the Middle Ages.
Can you explain that? Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
I mean, remember when people said no, voted no for the EU, but twice at the same time there was the votation for the being in the UN. So the first time they said no, but the second time they said yes. So they are in the UN now for I think almost 10 years now. But the thing is, I mean, it took them something like 600 years to be a confederation, and I think that the main point for them is that the confederation and all the cantons work together and work well together. So they're a lot more focused on, you know, on their territory. But we have a Department of Foreign Affairs, which is quite powerful, but in its own way. I mean, the sense we used to have I can't remember her name now, but we used to have this lady at she was the head of the Foreign Affairs Department, and she used to travel a lot, and she was asked to be the mediator in a lot of discussions, a lot of negotiations. But this is something which we don't really hear about. This is, I mean, we hear about that in Switzerland, but it's not really well known all around the world. There's no press about it.
Right, forgotten history. Hmm. What about the Swiss? Let's be a little bit critical now, because it's nice to hear the Swiss are very wonderful and independent now, but we've seen world wars swirling around the Swiss, and they're kind of standing there rubbing their hands. You can almost imagine somebody singing Edelweiss up on the high mountains watching the money coming in from the wars.
Yeah. As I said, I mean, banks are quite free to do whatever they want. I mean, there's no close look at what they do. I mean, this is really a private banking system. So for, till the UBS affair, I mean, they were really, really free to invest in what they want. And
you have this thing with numbered legendary numbered Swiss bank accounts.
Exactly.
So money can be paid from those accounts to a hitman, and no one can trace. There's no names involved. And in fact, I was reading recently that some Swiss accounts that you can have as a British person, for example, you can't find out what your balance is. You have to pay for somebody to fly to come and see you, and then they have an encrypted laptop. They open up the encrypted laptop, and then they show you your balance, and they close it, and then they fly back again, because there's an immense amount of secrecy involved still with the Swiss banking. But you've also got there the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. I'm not sure if you know much about that, but I was looking at that recently. That's the central banker's central bank. So Mervyn King, when he was, and Mark Carney, these people all going backwards and forwards to Switzerland, which is where all the central bankers meet. And one of the fascinating, it's a great book called The Tower of Basel by Adam Libor, all about that bank, who we had an interview with him on here a few years ago now, probably. He was saying that actually the Swiss government has got no jurisdiction. It cannot go in and arrest anybody in there or investigate anything inside this central banker's central bank. So between, Martin, I'll ask you this one, between London and Basel, where is the belly of the beast, really?
Well, I think what happens is, because Switzerland, it's to do with geography, they were the first to break out of a feudal setup because the geography allowed it. The Google War.
William Tell or what?
That's over era, yeah. And of course, because of the geography, they were able to pioneer sort of democratic forms and so on. But of course, they then became the headquarters of the international bourgeoisie, where they go to do their business. That's why Davos is every year in Switzerland. Where else? And of course, it became an obvious place. Geneva, the Geneva Convention. I mean, there's a positive side to this as well, that they became famous for mediation and so on. But at the same time, they also, there can't really be a legitimate reason for the level of secrecy in Swiss banks. There can't really. I mean, that level of secrecy is bound to lead to abuse, because it's just obvious that it will. Why can't they be transparent? I mean, the tax authorities in Germany and Italy are furious because all their money ends up in Switzerland, which is why, of course, you've not had any cuts in your austerity in Italy and elsewhere. People are sleeping in the street, but not in Switzerland.
Well, there's some people sleeping in the streets, but there is another system for charity. I mean, all these rich families, of course, are giving money. We don't know about it, but they are giving money to open shelters and open free restaurant for these people. But the main thing which makes me really feel like, okay, there is a kind of other debate in Switzerland, is the people actually they're trying to have this initiative for the Swiss government to tax more rich people, but not for opening private banking system and to make it transparent. What they are saying is, okay, you're rich, you have to pay more taxes. That is the people's claim, but the people don't really claim for opening the banking system to make it more transparent.
Well, can I just talk about something a little bit more positive, and that is that in Bristol tomorrow there's a training session for the Extinction Rebellion movement. So people will be coming from all over the country to get trained up on how to get involved in direct action of one sort or another in order to I suppose make politicians, make the press and make the public sit up and take notice about what it is that's messing up our environment particularly. But there's all sorts of other implications to this too, and I'll put a link up to where it's all taking place. I believe it's £20 to go along or something like that.
Just pay what you think you can afford.
Or pay what you can anyway. Now, George Monbiot said it was £20.
So yeah, but that's the official. If you just turn up and you haven't got £20, they'll let you in.
Okay, so anyway, so Bristol is to host a national mass rebellion training event tomorrow, hosted by Extinction Rebellion. It will teach non-violent direct action up to 1,000 people at a time. Now, the sort of workshops that they'll be doing here in the city are along the lines of Well, there's something called the Solution Zone, showcasing local and national solutions to the crisis. The gallery, art themed around the ecological crisis. The Art Factory, Let's Make the Rebellion Beautiful, to create much of the large art banners, which will be used from the 15th of April onwards. And the Sanctuary, a regenerative culture space. And I suppose that's where, if you've had a hard time during the day, you can chill out there for a while and enjoy that. But anyway, so that is, you know, quite nice positive things happening in Bristol tomorrow. And like I say, I'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and wish them all the very best of luck with that. But Martin, we must go back, I think, to talk a little bit about Northern Ireland, because mm-hmm. there are several stories relating to that. You mentioned it briefly just now, but we've got rather horrendous situation with these two journalists who did a book about the
it's a film.
Sorry, a film. You're right. Absolutely right. A film about something called the Lochan Island Massacre.
The Lochan Island Massacre,
and which is supposed to have been done by loyalists. Just explain that.
Well, this film is called
No Stone during the Troubles. The Irish Troubles.
This film is called No Stone Unturned, and it was made by ex-BBC journalists, but they made it as an independent film.
The BBC wouldn't let them, no doubt.
Well, they started working with the BBC, but the BBC then said, "No, we don't want this." So they went off to do their own.
Do you
own
remember
film.
Actually? That's the sort of thing that's happened quite a lot at the BBC over the years, where someone turns up to work on Monday morning and find the entire office disappeared.
But anyway, so they've made this film, and the film basically it was in 1994.
The journalists are Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney.
Yeah,
and let's have a listen now to their solicitor, Niall Murphy. Okay.
6 months to the day since both Trevor Burney and Barry McCaffrey were arrested in a police operation arising out of what we consider to be a malicious investigation in relation to the documentary No Stone Unturned. 6 months on, we are no further, and police today applied for an additional bail condition which would seek to restrict both Trevor and Barry from making public comment in relation to this case. That application was farcical, preposterous, and was robustly challenged by myself and Mr. McCaffrey's solicitor, John Finnegan. The application was ultimately refused by the adjudicating sergeant, the position that currently stands is that they have been bailed now for a further 6 months, so that will be a total of 1 year on police bail for a case that doesn't exist. There is no theft, there is no complaint of a theft, and that police have taken investigative action arising from this film and have arrested the two people that seek to tell the truth about the circumstances of the atrocity in Lochan Island is a farce, and it's a malicious farce.
Well, just as I was about to explain before, you had that clip of the solicitor of one of the journalists involved. Yeah, The massacre took place when people, it was in Lochan Island in north of Ireland, the Irish football team were playing the Italian football team, and people went to the pub to watch the match as well they might, and the loyalists turned up with machine guns and killed five people in the pub. But anyway, the police knew almost immediately who'd carried it out. There were the loyalist paramilitaries from the Ulster Volunteer Force, but nobody's ever been arrested because they were basically being protected by the police. And that's what this film, the police promised the relatives that there would be no stone unturned to catch the perpetrators, and then they protected them. So nobody's ever been arrested or questioned in relation to this massacre, even though it's pretty obvious that the police
sounds
knew from the get-go.
Sounds a bit like the Guildford Four and the Birmingham
Well, except this is the opposite end of it. These people are being protected rather than singled out. Now, of course, what the film has done, it's many years ago now, but they've interviewed everybody, they've gone back through it, and they've made a film which shows that the police were basically protecting right-wing terrorists. Yeah,
Sounds like the biggest criminals in the Troubles may have been the police.
Well, there's another film which we may cover another week, which is also out there, showing that the police were actually trying to encourage right-wing terrorists to kill more innocent people. And of course, that's when Karen Bradley, who didn't even know what the difference between a nationalist and a loyalist was when she was made Northern Ireland
Secretary.
Maybe
that's why she was made Northern
Ireland
Secretary.
Well, maybe it's why she's made Northern Ireland Secretary. She doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. Now, in actual fact, going back over all this stuff is not going to bring anybody back.
We have a look
but people
at
do
next
need
week,
to understand what really happened. It's not not just the wicked old IRA going around blowing things up. Also, the Loyalists have killed lots of people, and the British military were running the Loyalist paramilitary campaign.
Finally,
that's
Martin.
That's pretty clear.
Finally, we're going to look at the airliner Boeing Ethiopian Airlines ET-302. A bit of deja vu with the Lion Air crash last October. 157 dead this time, 189 dead last time. Two nosedives within 10 minutes of takeoff. Boeing has refused to ground the type. It's now finally, I think, done it after Trump told them to yesterday. We've had a week with these planes flying around that are basically death traps.
Well, I mean, you know more about aviation than I do, Tony, and what you've been suggesting, we were talking about before we came on air, that this is a software glitch which should have been ironed out.
Looks before a little bit they like flew. That. The thing is that Boeing tried to hide from the pilots what this system does, which it takes over. What it does is it pushes the stick forward in old-fashioned terms, so that if the plane looks like it might stall, that is to say run out of airspeed, it puts the nose forward in order to try and make it pick up speed. But what's happening is the pilots haven't been trained in how to switch this thing off when it goes wrong. And so they're panicking as the plane does a nosedive at full speed with the engines on full throttle down into the deck or to the sea. But finally, thank God, these things have been stopped from being used. But I'll put a link up to a great article by, Moolam, Alabama, I think it is, which talks about all the safety implications of this. The automation depends on only one sensor, which is crazy. So, time to sign off for the Comcast News at 8 now, American-owned. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Afzal Shah, to Martin Summers and Marie-Lou Storm. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing weekend. Martin Summers is back, thank goodness, now. Do please join us for the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
National News on the Hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.